This podcast is a part of the Policies That Perpetuate Systemic Racism project, supported by the Canada Race Relations Foundation. Join us as we explore the impact of the policy Zero Tolerance for Barbaric Cultural Practices Act. Through insightful conversations, we aim to shed light on the real-world consequences of this policy.
This episode picks up from our last discussion on the criminalization of gender-based violence under the Zero Tolerance for Barbaric Cultural Practices Act. We continue to examine the impact of this policy on survivors, particularly exploring why survivors might be hesitant and unlikely to seek criminal support against their perpetrators. We start our conversation with Deepa Mathew, who explains that this bill, instead of giving survivors more options, actually took away their access to supports, creating an environment of fear.
One big loss is that at individual level, like survivors who would have spoken about their experience and access resources without a fear of that, if I do a disclosure about it, I might be asked to report it. That fear is out there, right? And because it is an individualistic experience, and we haven't really done any longitudinal study on the impact talking to individuals, and because it's also very hard to find those individuals, or, you know, maybe right now as we speak, sitting on their computers looking for resources and help. And one of the things that shows up and is that forced marriage is a crime. And they're like, oh, so that means that I'll have to report against my family. Or that means that I'll have to report against this individual who is actually part of my caregiving circle. Do I do something about it? So that fear that it has created, and I always talk about people we are serving and people who are accessing our services and people we are able to do outreach to, all of those are great spaces, right? Because we are able to be connected. But what I fear about and what I really worry about, or what gives me sleepless nights, is the people who are not accessing anyone and they're looking up for help and understanding and unpacking it on their own. And for that individual level, I think there is a harmful discourse that has been created because there are no options. And doing the work from a trauma-centric way and doing the work from a client-centric way, what I've understood is that survivors need options. They need real choices. And when you take the real choices away from them and you force them, and the system creates a force of making a choice, which also, for example, in many cases happens because of mandatory charging, right? In domestic violence cases, we know that it creates a harmful environment at times for survivors to make difficult choices and or not make a choice because they don't want that intervention. So similar to that, I fear for repercussions at individual level in a big way.
One of the major concerns with this policy is the way it pits the survivors against their family members. Intimate family violence is a complex issue in itself, and the introduction of criminal penalties adds an additional layer of pressure on the victim. Deepa Mathew further points out, this approach to support and intervention overlooks the collective understanding of family dynamics, which is prevalent in many immigrant communities.
If we have to start analyzing what's wrong with the systems of supports, the first one is that the systems of supports were not designed for them. The systems of supports were designed around, as I said earlier in the conversation, around Eurocentric models. And the Eurocentric models are very much designed around a concept of individuals and not concept of collective communities and collective families, which are interdependent and they live their lives together. Their circle of care is way beyond extends that individual unit of individual person, also individual units of families, right? So that there is a lack of understanding of all of those cast of characters for how immigrant communities, by and large, not, again, I'm not trying to homogenize all immigrant communities, but by and large, most immigrant non-European communities believe in a very collective way of living life, and that there's a lack of understanding of that collective way of living life in our current systems and the way they were designed. There is a lot of great work happening, and there's a lot of great interventions that have been created that are outside the box. So that I see as one of the biggest barriers.
Deepa's thoughts on individualized versus collective ways of living are echoed by many others that I spoke to, including Shalini, Dr. Musina, and Dr. Jamal. Shalini highlights the discrepancy that this policy and criminalization creates between the consequences for families and the desired outcome by the survivor.
I think it's a complete misunderstanding to think anybody who calls you on a forced marriage issue, on a human trafficking issue, on an intimate partner violence issue, it's not our system, our sort of Western norms are that this is violence, you shouldn't accept it, you should leave. And ultimately, there's a part of me that feels like that too. But there's a larger part of me, having grown up in my own household and community, that know and understanding the system, that knows that there are people calling us who want an outcome and want to try to figure out things, but they're not looking to actually tear down their entire family and leave their family. Life is much more complex than what things like the Barbaric Cultural Practices Act says, which is we're going to charge your parents, they're going to go to jail or some criminal outcome will happen. In essence, doing things like that destroys an entire family. It destroys the relationship between our client, their parents, potentially other kids, potentially community members. There's a whole like ripple effect for that. And so we're always trying to think about with clients, what is the outcome you're looking for and can we get to it? Sometimes we're not going to be able to. Lots of clients tell us the outcome is I want you to convince my parents that this is wrong. That is unlikely. Well, we don't do that, right? And two, it's not likely that those things will happen quickly, right? Like it can happen over time, but not quickly. Or the outcome might be, I want to leave, but I want to still be able to have a relationship with my siblings, or my mom or my dad, depending on what it is, right? And so I think it's really important when you're doing this kind of work to remove yourself from the judgment of what you think should be happening. And just really put think about, you know, what role can you play in supporting the best outcome and giving people knowledge, right, about what they can do, how to keep safe, what they, you know, should be thinking about in terms of what are the issues that might come up. And that also giving them the strength to say it might be hard, but it's not insurmountable. So let us help you to see what we can figure out.
Instances of gender-based violence have proven to be difficult to be solved by punitive measures. Even in cases where the perpetrator is a romantic partner, survivors are less likely to find reporting the violence as a form of support. Dr. Jamal explains why mandatory charging does not work.
I did a project on the mandatory charging of violence against women. It was a major feminist accomplishment because previously, that was a civil issue. So if somebody called the police to report an issue of domestic violence, the police previously used to make them settle it among themselves. Or even if they didn't, after 1 or 2 days or 3 days or whatever, if the parties involved decided to end that case, they could do that. But with the mandatory charging, I think it was in the early 90s and late 80s that the feminist movement managed in Canada, managed to criminalize this kind of violence such that if anyone called the police, it could be the person, it could be the neighbor, it could be a teacher, anyone. If anyone called regarding gender-based violence, then the police were obligated to file a report and to charge, there would be a criminal charge against the perpetrator. And it was no longer obviously criminalizing that it is a crime against the state rather than a crime or an act against another person. And I was looking at the impact on it because one of the things that happened was that many racialized women, immigrant women, and especially South Asian Muslim women, stopped calling the police. Mm-hmm. And some of it could be because of their own immigration status. So I did events to focus groups and education awareness event with two mosques and a temple that showed that unless we look at survivor stories and talk to them, it's very hard to be able to really provide or come up with solutions that make sense. Having said that, I'm not saying that we should just decriminalize all kinds of violence and all, but on immigrant communities, those kind of criminalizing without really looking at the consequences, for example, might adversely affect these very people that you want to protect. So I found that women were not reporting. Very often they were emotionally so invested or involved, their partner and the children and the whole marriage or whatever, and so embedded in the community that they didn't want the marriage to end. They wanted the violence to stop. They wanted the behavior to change. They didn't want the relationship to end.
Deepa Mattu further elaborates.
It's taking that alternate way of creating an intervention and support. It takes that away, right? Because most in my 20 plus years or 25 plus years of work experience across the different parts of the globe is that survivors in every part of the globe and everywhere want the violence to happen. That's their first thing, right? Their first thing is, I want this to stop. They are not necessarily, when a woman is experiencing violence, she wants that violence to stop. She's not thinking about this person should be charged and this person should be behind the bar. That's not where survivors are, right? That's all systems' helplessness to create safety reacts into all of that. Because system feels so helpless and so feels is so failed into creating safety that they say, oh, if we do that, because now you want to create deterrence. And the deterrence, the system is for the lack of understanding of the full psychology of the crime and why crime of these nature happen and this violence happens. They believe that if we actually create a criminalized environment and put people behind the bars, that would stop the violence from happening next time. But it hasn't really stopped it from happening. So clearly, we need an alternate ways of intervention. And with specifically with the concept of the forced marriage or a so-called honor-based violence, in all of those kind of environments, clearly the interventions that are needed are way beyond the criminalization. It is the intervention for people to unlearn and learn things that have been perpetuating wrongfully, sometimes for generation after generation. It's intergenerational trauma that we are trying to address. And clearly, an intergenerational trauma can't be addressed with one criminal code change.
One recurring theme we hear is that survivors often don't wish for their relationships to end. Rather, they seek an end to the violence. They aspire to live a life free from abuse, but without the added burdens that can come from drastic action, like incarceration and deportation. What then becomes of survivors when their perpetrators are in prison? Unfortunately, more often than not, their lives do not change for the positive. They may even face increased hardships. Sabrina Zrock elaborates on this critical issue.
I think the biggest takeaway that we can take from this is what protections are in place for those who are victims of any form of gender-based violence. What protections are in place for them? If they were to tell authorities, I am not by consent now in a polygamous situation and I want out, okay. There are repercussions for the person who is perpetuating a polygamous marriage because that's seen as legal in Canada. What supports or protections are given to the woman who does not want to partake in that marriage? There aren't many. We have clients who have come to CCMW saying that they were just informed that their husband has another wife in another country, for example, or here in Canada, and they don't know what to do. It's easy for a service provider to say, okay, call the cops or okay, tell authorities, but there isn't a protection piece in place. And this bill just pushes people, particularly women and children, farther away from accessing justice. We've had women say they followed protocol. They were told by service providers, you should call the cops. If your husband laid a hand on you or was verbally abusive, you should call police. They call police. Then they call us and say, my husband is now in jail. What can I do? I have 3 children at home and I need help. And then service providers just hang up at that point because that piece of financial assistance, protection, how do you protect these women and children? What do they do next? There's a housing crisis right now. We see that homeless shelters are full and there's waiting lists for all of it. And then women are really, they're just stuck. They like fell in the gap. They can't access justice. And them and their children usually face the brunt of a lack of protection. And this bill does nothing but make it worse.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. We have now concluded our comprehensive examination of the policy Zero Tolerance for Barbaric Cultural Practices Act and its adverse effects on individuals, communities, and survivors. This policy, through its stigmatization of cultures as barbaric, has not only discouraged survivors from seeking help, but has also created a climate of helplessness and fear. It has failed to establish necessary support systems, and its punitive approach has been ineffective in addressing gender-based violence, especially as oppressive systems that sustain this violence continue to breed. Furthermore, this policy has intensified systemic racism, pushing survivors from racialized backgrounds further into the shadows and burdening racialized communities with combating racist stereotypes, all while silencing the voices of survivors. In our next and final episode, we will delve into effective strategies to combat these forms of violence and discuss progressive ways forward. Thank you for being with us, and we look forward to welcoming you to our next episode.